Okay. What I want to talk about is, if you haven't read the abstract, there's an interesting connection I've been exploring between the use of noise in signal processing, the constructive use of noise, and noise in quantum systems. And most of what I'm going to do is talk about the former, because I think it's been my experience in the limited time that I've been working on this that people aren't really familiar with it. And then I will discuss toward the middle or the end the potential of an analogy with what's going on in quantum systems, in particular, quantum systems that interact with a noisy environment. So the analogy is that, right, a system that an environment can act as a kind of noise source, which is coupled to the signal, which is corresponds to the particle or the particle state, and that the noise source can actually enhance detection of the properties of the particle. So first, we're going to look at dithering to mitigate what's called quantization error. And we'll look at examples from signal processing. Dithering is it's a sort of a semi-technical term which comes from, I think, the German, dithern. Who's German? Dithern is not a German verb?
Not that I recognize.
Well, you know, all right. What's that, Raphael? Well, it's certainly like a Yiddish term, to dither around, is to shake. And it was originally, dither was a technique used, was discovered in people built mechanical navigation systems for planes in, I believe it was the 40s or 50s, and found that they worked better in the air than they did on the ground. Of course, there's not much navigating to be done on the ground, but never mind that. The reason was that the shaking actually helped the system perform because it was a mechanical system and it was subject to getting stuck, the various cogs in it. And that's where the term was originally applied, and now, then it's used in signal processing, and I'm going to discuss those applications. And then finally, I'll discuss quantum systems. So, noise, I'm defining not super technically as random fluctuations impinging on a signal. And the idea here is that we're used to it, the idea that noise can degrade a signal, but in some cases, or many cases, depending on how you count them and what your measure is, can enhance it. Stochastic resonance phenomena are among those in which noise plays a constructive role, if you're familiar with. Many people are familiar with the term stochastic resonance, although it has such broad usage and that it's not quite clear what it denotes anymore. There are several papers exploring this. It doesn't always denote resonance, for one thing. The use of dither is a kind of stochastic resonance phenomenon, and it's noise added to what the cases we're going to look at are mostly audio signals or visual images like JPEG images or prior to quantization, which improves the resolution of the quantized image. So quantization, we'll see an example later of a visual image. You might have an image with a grayscale image with what did I do? I bumped into the thing. Never mind. Okay. You might have a grayscale image with, say, 256 shades of gray, and you might truncate it down to two shades of gray, a single bit. And if you apply dither, you can get a more, you can retain more of the detail of the original image. Okay, so if you add noise to that image, you'll also see that. Decoherence, I'll talk about this more later, but this is a, I'm going to suggest that you can look at these environmental interactions in a similar light, that the environment adds noise to a system and then allows you to resolve the properties of the object you're interested in. So digital audio, you may have, this is something that digital audio and digital sampling, I know Achim Kempf has given a couple of talks on. It may be familiar, may not be. It's, well, it's how CDs work and digital recording. It's based on the observation by Nyquist and Shannon that a band-limited signal can be encoded without loss by sampling the amplitude of the signal at a frequency of at least twice the bandwidth. And this sampling frequency is known as the Nyquist rate. So the idea is that the Fourier decomposition of the signal is bounded. It has a certain bandwidth, and if you sample in the time domain at twice the frequency of the bandwidth, then you can reconstruct the signal fully. Now, the fact that this technical point, the fact that the Fourier, in frequency space, the fact that the signal is bounded technically means that it's unbounded in time space. Of course, when we're actually, CDs are not infinitely long, but this turns out not to make a huge difference. It's in practice, you can have be bounded in frequency and bounded in time. The CD standard, as many of you know, many of you don't, is 44.1 kilohertz, which is a little more than twice the maximum frequency that humans can perceive. This the sort of the standard claim is that people can hear from between 20 and 20,000 hertz. Audiophiles like to argue about this quite a bit, and but that's that's where that comes from. And the idea is to you go a little bit above 40,000 hertz in your sampling to allow for various difficulties associated with filtering out any of the content above 20,000 hertz from the signal. Okay? So, wow, what this is, does not show up that well. Okay. C'est la vie. So in the real world, the amplitude can't be measured or stored with arbitrary precision. So what do I have here? Can you, I don't know if anybody can see this. If we turn like all the lights out in the, what's that? You see the blue line. Yes, that's the least important part.
I'm beginning to see the red.
Right, the red, there's little red dots here. Okay, so I should use the hockey stick. And Matt is doubling his AV guy here. Thank you, Matt. I don't know if this will help. Dot, I can point out each dot individually. There we are. Beautiful. Thank you.
We reduced the noise.
Yes, we reduced the noise and increased the signal, so my whole talk is completely gone. Okay, so this just represents, as you can see, this is the this is time, this is amplitude, this is a sine wave of some sort, and this is the sampling rate is the distance along the t-axis here, and the resolution the resolution is not, it's not obvious from here, but the idea is that you can only resolve, the resolution has to do with the precision with which you can specify the amplitude at any given time, okay? So you can only write down so many decimal places, so to speak. So we're talking bits, we're talking binary places. So most modern recording is done with a bit depth of 24. And with this level of precision, the quantization error, as it's called, so this is confusing in a talk on quantum foundations. I talk about quantization error. It doesn't have anything to do directly, anyway, with quantum mechanics. The difference between the real value and the recorded value, that's the quantization error. So it's the real value is some real number, and you can only specify that to so many bits. So with 24 bits, it's largely inaudible. But there's a reason, there are several reasons why you typically record with 24 bits or more. Sometimes people use 32 bits. It has to do with signal processing, in which you're multiplying and adding the signal, and you really want a lot of extra decimal places to carry around information because you're losing it all the time. Okay, so finite precision. So you can't reproduce the signal. What's that?
24 bits is not even a single precision. Is it? Or
it's not even a what?
Yeah, but in the computer it's called a single precision real number.
I don't know what that.
32 bits, but including.
Why would you need a single precision number?
I don't know, but it seems in practice you don't get good results.
No, but it depends on, you know, whether that thing that you're making an error of is within the, you know, if you try to model it as a sine wave, whether that sine wave is a frequency greater than the Nyquist frequency or not. And most likely it does, and then you don't have a sample.
Right. I mean, there's a whole bunch of engineering trade-offs that give rise to why this is done and why you sample at 44. You can, so interestingly, if we just a little diversion, the way actual processors, quantization processors work, things that do this sampling, they typically use a much higher frequency rate. It's called oversampling, and they sample one bit, and then they convert it to a 24-bit representation at 44.1 or 88.2 or whatever you want to use. But all this, the reason 24 is used is because it used to be people recorded with 16 or sometimes even 8 bits, but because the more bits, the more storage you need, and the more time it takes to do whatever signal processing you're doing, multiply and divide. So that's where this is all. These limitations are, you know, largely consequences of technological limitations, which have now been not completely transcended. But 24 is easy. Increasing the sample rate actually is puts more of a load on your system. We can keep going, and then we can come back to this if you'd like. Anyway, this is a it's in theory a Dirac delta function, but this is what I'm showing you is just an example of well, this is an actual application it's a spectrum analyzer of in this case it's supposed to be a 1 kilohertz signal. The scale should be on the bottom here but isn't. So this is 1000 hertz. Spikes here, nothing down, no noise here, at least down to minus 150 dB, which is really pretty quiet. So not a problem at 24 bits, okay? In other words, you're not getting a lot of much in the way of artifacts from using a 24-bit number and not an infinite precision number. The width of this has to do with as a limitation of the frequency analyzer, is not a limitation of the quantization. Okay. So when you reduce the bit depth, and this is going to be relevant for the quantum case, why would you reduce the bit depth? For one reason, CDs are encoded with a bit depth of 16. Only 16 bits per sample on a CD. And that was deemed at the inception of the CD technology to be plenty adequate for music reproduction. Now, people will argue about that, but in any case, it's pretty good. 16 bits is pretty good if you do it right. But what happens is if you record, so let's just sort of take a look at this. You can sort of start to see the error, for instance, up here. If you're using a 16-bit number, not a 24-bit number, the curve at the top of your sine wave might get cut off. That's a little, so that's going to be a little distortion. It's going to be a little high frequency component in the signal. Well, everything is going to be somewhat more jagged. I don't have a true sine wave on there to compare it to, but obviously the lower the bit depth, the more you're going to deviate from the actual pure tone. And you know, you can consider a 2-bit sample, which is sort of the extreme version. Okay, in other words, if you're doing 2-bit sampling, if you're above here, it's a 1, and if you're below here, it's a 0, and that's it. Okay, so that wouldn't be very good, because then your sine wave would look like this, and this, would be kind of a step function. And when you convert it back to analog, it's going to be a mess. Okay, so the moral of this is that if you record at 24 bits and then you truncate the last 8 bits, or if you record at 16 bits in the first place, you're going to get more quantization error and you're going to start getting noise in your signal. So what do you do about that? I'm speaking a little bit loosely here when I say noise, because I'm going to use noise in two different ways. When I say you get noise in the signal, one of the things you're going to get, typically, depending on the signal, is you'll get harmonics of the original signal. So it's noise with a certain pattern. What it sounds like is just kind of nasty artifacts. The kind of good noise that you might prefer to nasty artifacts, which sort of sound like signal but aren't part of the original signal, it's something like white noise, or pig noise for that matter, some just even hiss, because your brain just sort of blocks that, just sort of subtracts that out, doesn't notice that. It's a constant. Now, this is a spectrum taken of that 16-bit sample. So you can see what's happened here. Is you still have the spike at 1,000 hertz, and then you have, I'm sorry, there's no scale down here. I took this out of I didn't produce this particular plot, because no spectrum analyzer I have goes below 120, minus 120 dB. This does. So what you have here, among other things, these are all harmonics. These are multiples of 100. And they go off to going off into the low frequencies, and I believe they're doing that in the upper frequencies. But this is a logarithmic plot, so this is 20,000 hertz up here. So everything gets kind of, the harmonics start getting really bunched up. Okay.
I don't understand. The lower frequencies are not harmonics. Harmonics are always the higher frequency.
Right. That's true. So they're multiples of, so these are multiples, but this would be like a, what is this? This is, this is just like, it's 900, I believe, 800, 700, 600, 5, 4. And I don't know why there's a gap here. They're multiples of 100. You're right. The harmonics are going to be 1,000, 2,000, 3, you know, multiples of the fundamental frequency. All right. So, dithering, what are you doing? The way to get rid of this is to add noise. It can be white noise, which is spread evenly across the frequency spectrum, or you can use more sophisticated forms of noise, which still get called noise. The real idea is that you're adding something to the signal which is not correlated with the signal. All right. Quantization error is always going to be correlated with the signal. In other words, let me just go back. The error at here is going to be the same as the error at the next time the sine wave oscillates. is the same, and it's the same, is the same. So in that sense, the error is correlated with the signal when you're just, when you're doing this kind of, when you're recording it, say 16 bits, or you're recording it 24 bits and truncating. You have this long number, and it's gonna be the same everywhere along the pure tone. Okay. So what dithering does, interestingly, is it eliminates the artifacts of the quantization. It's going to eliminate this stuff. So here's what it does. So this is a plot which describes the behavior of the dithering in this. What is that? The dithering in ozone, which is a little application which is for allows you to master a CD. The yellow is what we were just looking at, and the white is what you get if you add white noise to the signal before you truncate. So you're taking the 24-bit signal, I'm sorry, the 24-bit representation, so you have 24 bits at each sample, and you're adding a random number, I'll show you in a second, in the eight least significant bits. That amounts to noise, which is spread among the spectrum from 0 to 20K. And that's what is represented here. So on the one hand, you sort of raise the noise floor, although what's called the noise floor, although the noise floor isn't really well defined in the absence of dither, because you know there's nothing here, then it comes up to minus 132 here, and so on. So this is even. This you hear is hiss, if you hear it at all. This stuff is messy. So you've basically improved the resolution to something that looks a lot more like the 24-bit representation by adding noise before you quantize the signal. All right, so what is it? This is just a, I don't know if this is helpful or not. The noise is a random number. This is a 24-bit number, I think, 4 times 6. And the noise is going to be a random number between this and, I should have put it all in the same line, and this. Okay. So if you add that to the signal, which is just some number of this form, it has the effect, it's quite interesting, of bringing, this is something that is actually happening in stochastic resonance as well. It brings some of the information in the eight least significant bits into the 16 remaining bits. Okay, because you're adding, occasionally you're going to change this number. And the change in this number is going to be partly a function, not that number, this number here. Okay. You're adding an arbitrary You're adding an arbitrary number here, and it can get carried over and change this. So what it has the effect of doing is to bring some of the information in the eight least significant bits into the 16 remaining bits, while also at the same time ensuring that the quantization error is decorrelated from the signal. Okay, and that's why it shows up as just hiss. Okay, it doesn't, it's spread completely across the frequency. When we were looking at just this pure tone, when we don't dither, we have these things, all these spikes are functions of the fact that our primary signal is at 1 kilohertz. And this line, the dithered signal, is now disassociated. In other words, if we had a 2 kilohertz signal, you're gonna get the same pattern of noise here, okay? It'll just be a spike, but located over here with the same even white noise. So it does a couple of different things. And one of the things, the ways that it manifests itself is that when you fade one of these signals, You're bringing the volume down, say at the end of a song. You can actually, in some sense, hear below the noise floor. I'm not going to go on about this, but it's a function of the fact that you've kept some of the information about the original signal. So your ear is able to sort of separate out figure for this because we're in the frequency domain here. But when the signal goes below the level of the noise, you can still, your ear can distinguish some of the sound. So even when you could start to hear the hiss, you can often hear the instruments or whatever's going on, even though it's when it gets quite low. Yeah.
Question. I'm surprised that you don't get another peak at 2 kilohertz. I mean, why are there no higher harmonics? Wouldn't you expect to get all the higher harmonics of multiples of the frequency?
Well, it's actually not clear what you expect. I mean, and because it depends not only on the signal but also on the sampling frequency. But you do have peaks all along here. I mean, this is a completely jagged signal. And there, you know, continued peaks all the way up to 20K. Is that different from what you'd expect?
Well, like, for example, if you would take a step function and do a Fourier transform, you would get the frequency, but then you would get higher harmonics of that. So you would get twice the frequency sequence and so on of the signal. So clearly you do a better sampling. Maybe it's just the sampling as you're saying, but I kind of naively would expect to have something in the higher harmonics.
You mean you would expect something? You would expect something more of that amplitude in the higher frequencies?
Something is coming out in the 2 kilohertz. I kind of would expect another.
Well, there is. It's just down at 100 minus 120 dB. Is that?
Yeah, but the ones right and left. It's not clear. It's not a clear peak. I would say. It must be the sampling, because you have the sufficiently high sampling.
Yeah, this turns out to be, I don't have a quick and dirty answer for what patterns you would expect in the frequency spectrum given, this sampling rate and this tone. I mean, the only reason it's as simple as this is, actually it gets simpler if you use a multiple or a fraction of the sampling frequency. But 1,000 hertz is not a simple, fraction of 44.1 kilohertz. What happens if you use an arbitrary signal is this looks pretty even, okay? If you use a signal that looks more like noise, then this starts to look like white noise. So the reason it's spiky here is that your primary signal is a pure sine wave. That's what you're putting in. But this is a problem with, of course, the things you're interested in are kind of what you might call low entropy functions. I mean, they're not, you don't have pure tones in music, but you have instruments playing notes. And usually that's a frequency with some harmonics on top of it. And you get these kind of artifacts. And you can actually, the important thing is you can hear the difference here. You can hear the difference between this, the yellow plot, just the truncated sine wave, and the dithered sine wave.
Do you know how long it was sampled for?
You mean what produced this?
What amount of time?
This is some windowed fast Fourier transform, and I don't, there are different window shapes and different amounts of time you can sample for. Of course, none of this is, of course, infinite time. And you do get slightly different results. That's about all I can tell you on that. So, yeah?
If you know that you're getting a pure tone, then it's clear that dither helps you to recover the signal.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were given if you knew that your signal was going to be initially random, then the dither would definitely hurt your recovery of the original signal. Do you know what I mean by that? If you're imagining generic signals, and maybe I give you a random signal in either frequency or time space, then
random function.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you quantize it. If you dither before quantizing, then it's not going to help you. It's actually going to make it worse. And
I'm not sure it'll make it worse. Are you sure that it'll make it worse?
It does seem clear to me, but I might be.
Yeah. What's that?
That's not obvious to me either.
Okay. Well,
if you add a very large dither, then, and the quantization is relatively small, you're going to have a much harder time reconstructing the original signal.
Well, that's true. I mean, you don't want the dither to be larger than the.
Well, you do want it larger than the, like, half with the quantization, right?
Yeah, but you don't want it far bigger. You get large dither, for instance, when you're using single bit quantization.
Yeah.
Then you need a fairly large dither signal, because what you need to do is you need to induce variation in the signal so that something of the signal survives when you truncate it. So you take your pure sine wave and you add a ton of noise to it, and then you, I can't do it from here, but you would have just a pure, it would look like a step function without the dither. With the dither, it's a little involved, because what you end up having to do, you do have to oversample it. Okay, and what you do is then you take the average, it's called decimating.
You take the average of the samples and you get down to the, so what you're getting from the dither, I'm not going to say this as clearly as I would like right now, but what you're getting is a kind of ensemble, a stochastic, a probabilistic ensemble. Which allows you to sample more of the space than you otherwise would. I'll show you just a visual image. It might, of dither, I think, I'm not sure if it's the next slide. Yes, it is. So this is, I'm not sure. I think these are two bits. So this is I don't know what, this is some grayscale image. This is just pulled off the Wikipedia page, not surprisingly, for dither. This is what happens when you truncate it. This is like single bit quantization. It's either black or white. Doesn't look like much. And this is what happens if you add noise to this before you take it down to two bits. I believe this is a two-bit image. These are almost exactly, but not quite, these are almost the same size. Okay, so this may be more helpful. This has nothing directly to do with frequency, but you can sort of maybe get a better intuitive feel for what's going on, what the noise is doing. It's there are several different ways of doing this for visual images. You can make the value of a pixel, you can make the noise correlated so that it has something to do with what the neighboring pixels look like or not. There are various trade-offs, file size, processing speed. But you get the basic idea that this is there's more information, at least that you would be interested in, about the original image in this than there is in this. I mean, you can't really see the eyes here at all. Here you can see the eyes. You can see that this person has an iris and a pupil, which is, important. Nostrils, and so on. So that's what an example of the use of dither in visual images. And this has been going on. There's a whole bunch of different dither schemes. Okay. So I want to say a little bit about quantum mechanics. This is just a qualitative brief discussion of coherence. So consider the two slit experiment for individual electrons or photons. So in other words, a two slit experiment with one particle at a time, and you have a slow buildup of an interference pattern on the screen if there's no interactions of significance on the way between the slits and the barrier. The usual way of describing this is you have a plane wave impinging on the slits, which is corresponds to a particle of roughly determinate momentum. And what you have is a coherent superposition of the wave coming out of one slit when the wave coming out of the other slit, so that the phase relationship between those waves is determinate. And that's what gives you the interference pattern. If you disturb that phase relation, which is what happens when you have decoherence, you destroy the interference pattern. So if the particles undergo interaction, and I'm not analyzing here the particular nature of the interaction, I know it's not entirely trivial. The appropriate interaction with dust or some other medium on the way to the screen, the interference pattern disappears. And quantum mechanics is accounting for this by positing that the interactions modify the phase of the particle's wave function. And they do it in a way that's different for the component of the superposition emanating from one slit and the component from the other slit. Basically, this wave function, in this case, it's a single particle, so you can think about it as a wave function dispersing in space, because the configuration space is just R3. And you're interacting with particles in one region of space which have properties which are not correlated with the particles in the other region of space. So the way that the wave function, the way that the phase changes for this branch is going to be uncorrelated with the way it changes for this branch. So the relative phase does not stay constant. So coherence is lost, so is the interference pattern. That's roughly the quantum mechanical description. Okay. So here's the idea. If we abstract away from the specifics of the quantum model, okay, so we stop thinking directly in terms of quantum mechanics, you can view this situation as one in which you have a particle interacting just with a noisy environment, which the environment doesn't know about the particle. So the environment, we're not using quantum mechanics to describe it. We're going to just assume, though, that the state of the environment is not correlated with the state of the particle. That's what I mean by the environment doesn't know about the particle. So we're effectively adding noise to the signal, which is the generalized state of the particle. So ordinarily, we tend to think of this as destructive. We're destroying information that's really there, you know, especially if we have an ontological view of the quantum state or ontic view. And we think of the phase information and the state getting dissipated into the environment and thrown away. So the noise is destructive. But here's another way to think about it, suggested by what we were just looking at in terms of audio and visual signal processing. If you think about measurement as involving a kind of coarse graining, which you can just think of as even more minimally, a kind of coarse graining is just saying that the measurement has finite accuracy. You can only do it to so many decimal places. If you assume that, then it might be the case that the environmental noise, the noise that's getting dumped into the signal by the environment or contributed to the signal, enhances the detection of the state of the particle, just as it does when the dither is applied to the 24-bit signal prior to truncating it down to 16 bits, or it's added to that grayscale image before truncating that image down to a 2-bit image, just a black and white image. Now, you can further speculate, and I think this is interesting, but this requires a little bit more work. you say, okay, fine. That's so the picture so far is, well, I'm actually gathering more information about the particle when it's interacting with a noisy environment, when it's undergoing what we call, in the quantum mechanical picture, called decoherence, than I am otherwise. So what am I observing otherwise? What's the analogy of a particle that's not interacting with an environment, that's protected from decoherence? Well, this is like, it's protected from decoherence, but we're still maintaining that our measurement has finite precision. So, what we ordinarily have in the quantum case, in the quantum description, was we have an interference pattern. And the suggestion from thinking this way is that maybe the interference pattern is actually an artifact of the finite resolution of the measurement process. Okay? So, in other words, the signal doesn't interact with the noise and is distorted. Remember that yellow plot in frequency space? You get all these weird spikes at different frequencies. That the measurement is distorted by measurement. And it's possible that quantum mechanical interference is a kind of distortion induced, as I said, by the finite resolution of the measurement process. So that the interference, which is always, of course, problematic. You know, what does interference mean? What is it telling us about how does a particle interfere with itself, a single particle interfere with itself? Well, on this picture, it's an analogy which needs to be fleshed out. The interference is something which is it's a measurement phenomenon. It has to do with the quantization error induced by measurement. Okay, so what to take away from this? I think this is very interesting, regardless of what you think about the quantum mechanical analogy, which I think is actually quite intriguing, but needs to be developed. This is very important, I think, in understanding nature. It's coming up a lot in biology now. I mean, it's already, if you look at the theory of natural selection, of course, that already depends on noise because it depends on a source of variation in the genome against which you can select. But there's many other models of, for instance, gene expression in the cell, which use noise in the cell to have noise in the cell playing a fundamental role in the process. Okay, some of this has been explored. There are many papers on stochastic resonance, some of it hasn't. But I think it's very useful to keep in mind that noise does not always, depending on the context, it does not always destroy a signal, it can enhance a signal. The general phenomenon that we're examining is one in which you have a threshold below which a higher resolution signal can't be resolved. Okay, that's common to a lot of examples of stochastic resonance. This also comes up in brains and neuron firing. So this is a sort of a more general way to think about when noise can be beneficial. Or it can help us accomplish tasks. So this part has to do with the analogy with quantum mechanics, which I think is interesting. I mean, I've thought about it in part because I've long thought that environment-induced decoherence is important to understanding the emergence of classicality, but it doesn't really completely explain it. This is a debate I probably shouldn't have even mentioned. But there's a couple of issues you might have with that. It certainly doesn't completely explain why you get a single outcome. It at best gives you something close to a classical statistical distribution over classical trajectories. But anyway, what is noise doing? What is decoherence doing? This is a way of thinking that sort of takes you outside. It asks you to sort of just step back from the quantum formalism and think about, okay, I have an environment. It's impinging randomly on my system. What might that do to my system? And so the phenomenon of dither and stochastic resonance is being sort of brought to bear on the quantum systems. And finally, speculatively, I think this is intriguing, measurements of systems that don't undergo decoherence may display artifacts of this finite resolution of the measurement process. Now, I haven't given a principled example of why the measurement process must have finite resolution. You see this a lot, and when people are discussing hypercomputation, I don't know if people are familiar with that result. You can build, in theory, you could have an analog computer which can compute non-computable functions if it can use real numbers. And the usual counter argument is, well, we can't measure real numbers. We can only measure things with finite precision. Now, it's probably important to this discussion whether finite means definitely bounded by some particular number, or finite means a number of arbitrary but finite length. I think only if you can find a number which is, only if you have the former are you going to have a shot at explaining, at applying this kind of model to quantum phenomena. But you do have a natural scale in quantum mechanics, and it's given by H bar, so I think this is not implausible. Anyway, there's a lot to think about here, I think, and I'd like to have any questions you might have right now.
Background question. What is stochastic resonance? I'm not sure.
Right.
It's not that familiar to me.
Stochastic resonance, well, there are, I think, I've come across at least two papers titled exactly that, what is stochastic resonance? And one of the early, one example is, I'm trying to remember, I think it's you have just some amplitude of a function below which you can't detect. So you have something varying that's sort of below the detection level, and you dump a bunch of noise into the system, and the noise occasionally kicks this thing above the threshold. And that allows you to detect with some properties of the system with some probability.
So you mean the noise might happen to be in resonance with the signal?
Yes.
That's
where the resonance.
That's why the word stochastic resonance.
Yeah, right. But it's been applied to contexts in which there's not really any resonance. Well, there's no real resonance here. In fact, somebody from Waterloo about 10 years ago, Robert Wanamaker, anybody know him? I think in electrical engineering, wrote a whole thesis on dither, its relation to stochastic resonance, and also the question, I forget who asked it, about what sorts of noise you can expect from various kinds of quantization error. What leads to what? Okay. I have a certain kind of signal, and I have a certain quantization error. What do I expect the spectrum of noise to look like? Are there any particular properties? Other questions? Matt, yeah.
So how do you want to think about entanglement and non-locality on your analogy?
Well, I don't would be the facetious answer. I've sort of thought about that, but I don't have I haven't really gotten anywhere with that yet. I thought, right, so would you run up entanglement and non-locality together?
Sorry?
Would you put entanglement and non-locality, this is just a question back for you, together? I mean, can you think about non-locality in the absence of entanglement?
You're applying the superposition principle to composite systems, then you're going to get entangled states, right? Mm-hmm. That's prima facie different from violating Bell.
Right. Okay. Other questions?
So if I understand right, you're saying that interference may be an artifact of finite resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then decoherence is like having zero. But so if you do that, what like, are you suggesting therefore a kind of classical with the idea of a classical model of interference? And what would be the background physics in which you would have that possible?
I'm reluctant to just go, well, a classical model can mean two things. It can mean, you know, this thing is a wave, some classical wave in physical space, or a particle. That's what I sort of understand classical model. And I'm not sure that that's the right way to think about it. But I don't know. That's why I called it a kind of a generalized state. The main focus was, though, was really to sort of think about noise as telling you something additional, enabling you to find out something additional about whatever it is, about the state or the particle that the state represents, that you wouldn't otherwise expect. Yeah.
Yes, I have a practical thing. Let's suppose I do an interference experiment, right? And I do not see the interference pattern.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's a problem of my resolution, which is, I think the answer would be you have to increase your resolution. I mean, you're saying you don't need to do that, you can just add noise. And then the other thing is, it seems to me...
Well, actually, I'm just...
You need to have a very high control on your noise if you really want to have an enhancement or uses in your favor. It seems to me that you anyway need to know a lot about your state to begin with, and then you have to have a control on the noise. At least in the audio case, it was this...
Well, okay, two things. So in answer to the first question, I mean, that speaks to what I was just sort of saying at the end. You do need, I think, a fundamental limit on resolution. You need to find some sort of principled... It's not clear, by the way, what's being limited here, okay? Whether it's some combination of, you know, whether of position and momentum or energy. What is it that I can't resolve beyond a certain bound? But I do think you need a bound, otherwise this isn't going to work. It's not going to, it doesn't work if you just say, okay, for any given measurement resolution, I mean, for the reasons you're saying, any given measurement resolution, I'm going to expect a certain quantization error, and I'm going to need a certain amount of noise. Well, maybe I don't have that amount of noise. In answer to the second point, I think it's interesting, but I think also you do, you know, in the real world, when we're actually doing these experiments, if you have too much environmental noise, you're never going to have anything show up at the barrier, period. Okay, you know, I mean, if the particle is interacting, so if you know, too much noise, you're not going to get, well, you're going to start losing particles completely. There's a certain kind of interaction, a certain level of interaction, which will give you something that looks as if the particles are following classical trajectories. And as that comes down and down, then you regain the interference pattern. So I think that's part of our picture. But I think I take the point that you need to put some, what it needs is, I think, some dimensional arguments that show that this is plausible, you know, without a particular theoretical model. What are the natural, what are the scales that I have to work with? I mean, I have Planck's constant to work with, and then I have the size of the system. And is something like this
possibly at work.
Who?
I just have a technical question about how you actually do deep learning in practice.
Uh-huh.
If I understood right, here the plots that you showed us were when you started with a 24-bit signal.
Yeah.
Right? And then you want to truncate it to 16 bits. Would something like, let's say that 24-bit signal that you started with is already quantized in a sense. You're not going, the dithering happens in between going from a digital thing to another digital thing.
Right.
You
can also do it to an analog signal.
So with an analog signal, you would do it by like actually, you know, like let's say I'm recording myself playing guitar or something.
Yeah.
I would turn on some actual white noise in the background.
Yeah, well, it turns out that for a lot of practical purposes in recording, the noise in your equipment serves as dither, because nothing you have you're recording with is silent. And so that there's very low level noise, and that is related to sort of the initial analog to digital conversion, even when you're converting a continuous signal to a 24-bit signal.
Maybe ask you out.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
If you have a single sample of your signal, or like just one random variable, and you and it say it's going to be between 0 and 1,
uh-huh.
and you're going to quantize it to either 0 or 1, right?
Okay.
So,
single bit. Yeah.
So if you add some Gaussian noise on top of that.
Yeah.
Before you quantize it, then you end up doing worse off, right? Does that make sense so far?
What, the original signal, I'm sorry, remind me, is...
So I give you like a uniform random number between 0 and 1.
Oh, okay.
And you want to, and then you're going to quantize it, and then you want to be able to recover, say, close to what it, you want to make a best guess at what it was. So your best
I
guess
see.
Would just
yeah.
be 0 or 1, because the four. Maybe
right,
maybe
you're right. It makes sense that you would do worse. Yes.
Yeah. So So then I was thinking, this is going somewhere in a second. So then I was thinking that if you have if you take a random signal,
yeah.
several of these random signals in a row, so it's just a random signal in your space of possible signals,
uh-huh.
then adding white noise everywhere will make you do worse overall, I would think. You can't. If your goal is to get a closest distance to the original signal by doing some reconstruction, you'll do worse if you.
I see how you got there. Okay.
Or another
mm-hmm.
way to see it is that
mm-hmm.
if you take that the image of the woman that you had that was post.
That was the. That wasn't a woman. That was David, I believe. It's what men used to look like, apparently. That's all right.
What gay sculptors thought they should look like.
Yeah.
But if you
you take that image. Yeah.
If you look at say the cheek region or something where it's spatially homogeneous, you see a bunch of black and white and black and white.
Uh huh.
And any individual pixel may not actually be any closer. In fact, I would think it's probably even a worse estimate of what the. Of what the value at that pixel was,
mm-hmm.
but your eye is able to somewhat reconstruct it because you're working on the prior that there's some spatial homogeneity on the image. So say if I take that image and blur it a little bit, then I'll get close to a reconstruction of the original image.
Wait, are you asking me or are you, what are you?
Well, there was a, maybe I'll just come talk to you after if it's too involved.
I think
I was
making,
sort of, I was
well,
suggesting
yeah,
that.
I'm just,
question
you could try it again. I'm just not quite getting the, Raphael, do you want to flesh it out?
I think the idea is that if you don't apply dither,
yeah.
then by subsequent processing, you can do better. Be it dither or whatever else, by subsequent processing, you can do better than if you were handed the dither image.
Right.
Is that the suggestion, basically?
Actually,
In other words, you have more information. So if you use it in the right way, you can do at least as good as you could have. Whatever you're aiming for, you could do it as well.
Well, on the picture of the face.
What you could do if you had only the dithered image.
Well, let me see. I mean, to some extent, this is about retrieving information. It's sort of observer dependent. I mean, in the audio case. So the extent to which people can detect the signal as it goes below the noise floor varies. So defining a signal to noise ratio in that kind of circumstance is not really clear cut. So sometimes people will say, well, okay, I have a 16-bit signal, but with dither, I have effective bit depth of like 20 bits. So, but, you know, somebody else might not be able to hear that far into the noise. Now, I'm trying to think about what, I think I see your general point. So what is your sense? I'll throw it back at you. What is your sense of when dither is useful and when it isn't? Do you have, I mean, it's clearly useful, well, with those images, right? The dithered image looks, and it carries more information intuitively. Yeah.
I think dither definitely does help. I mean, on the face, it's pretty clear that it helps you reconstruct the, if you take the non-dithered image that was quantized, you don't see any of the shading, et cetera.
Right.
But I think that you need spatial correlation, you need some prior knowledge of spatial correlations for the dither to help you. And in the case of the picture, natural images have sort of low spatial variance, and that's what we're using there. And on a single bit, it doesn't help you at all because you're not correlating it with anything else. And I, if you...
Okay, so we're making an inference that depends on some implicit prior in our brains.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a prior about local spatial correlations. And I think that has some implications for the quantum analogy if you think about it.
Yeah.
That's what it's got.
That may be. On the other hand, the non-dithered image does have less information in the sense that it's lower entropy. I mean, because basically what you've done is you've sort of applied a function, well, a very simple function, a truncation to this this signal. You've thrown away a bunch of information. And now you're putting, what the randomness does is it puts back variety. There are more possibilities, so it's a higher entropy in the final image. So that's one, that's sort of an, that's an attempt to give a sort of a more objective argument for there being more information. It's not being entirely subjective that there's more information in the dithered image. But I do want to try to reconcile it with your initial point about the single bit, which I think was interesting. Did you want to follow up on that? Sorry.
Or you could take a totally random image, which is just totally structureless, and then I guess also the dithered would not help you in reconstructing. It would only make things worse.
Right. That's probably true. But that, you know, I think that it's worth keeping in mind that we don't deal in physics typically with random states. You know, an arbitrary state of a massively entangled system is completely random. It doesn't have any particular properties. And what we're doing, when we're looking at something like a two-slit experiment or any sort of, you know, experiment that's supposed to demonstrate interference effects, we're looking at an extremely low entropy source designed to prepare the state. So we're looking at it, we're in a sort of a, well, we're in the low entropy portion of state space. So that's just sort of a cautionary note about worrying about generic states. Like, what does it say about generic states? Well, are we interested in generic states physically? Not clear. Yeah.
If you have these images, right, the one where you just reduce the bit size and the other with added noise. I mean, and I look at them, and the one looks better than the other from just the visualization, right, from the eye, or if you listen to audio recording. But if I were to do an error analysis with the original one, wouldn't always the one with the noise give me a bigger error? And is that what you do in any experiment? At the end, you have some result, but you don't just say, oh, this looks roughly like the shape I want. You would compare it with the theory, and the question is, what? It's a different way of look, you know, it's different. If something looks better, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a better fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the questions is going to be how you're doing the error analysis, which is actually related to how you do the dithering, because, you can look at how accurate, how far off is an individual point, but then you can look at correlations between neighboring points. And did that, I have some on the grayscale image, I have some sort of presumably distance between adjacent points, and then, topology is my enemy in this right now, but nearby points, points that are further away, so that's, it's not clear to me that we're going to get a unique answer to that question, although it may be a useful way to think about it.
Well, you showed us that if one were to do the error analysis by Fourier, this is the audio case.
Oh, yeah.
By Fourier transforming the signal first and looking how well the curves match, then it did much better with the view. So that's a form of, if that's your choice of
It did better in the sense that it's more even. But as far as, what you do have, though, in the dithered case, is your noise floor is just, it's higher than in the 24-bit case. So you have,
I think
but it's uniform.
The maximum excursion between the true signal and the sample signal.
The maximum excursion is going to be lower.
It was lower in the case of the dithered. So if
But that's related to what I just said.
Yes. Yeah. What is your metric for doing the error analysis?
Right.
Is it an L2 difference? Is it is it a uniform norm? Is it some other,
mm-hmm.
which looks nicest to us? Some,
yeah.
On a scale of 1 to 10? Those are all different notions of how far out.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I think one way to possibly clean up the confusion about which image is better in the end or which metric you're going to use,
mm-hmm.
is if you state that your goal is to not just look at the final image, but to do a reconstruction and then judge how close that is to the original image. And if you're going to allow yourself any reconstruction algorithm, but you're going to base it on some prior about the original image. And then at that point, I don't think it'll really matter which metric you use for the final comparison. And for the case of the face, if you do a very slight blurring and averaging of neighbors, then you'll get very close to the original image. Whereas if you look at the undithered image, you won't get at all close. There's no way to recover the original image.
Independent of your prior?
Oh, I mean,
is that what you? I thought that's what you were. What you were trying to say?
So, the prior being that there's some spatial.
Well, you're trying to reconstruct the image, and then you have any information? I mean, there's a lot of ways to extend a one-bit image that are consistent with,
Yeah.
So how do you do it?
You could formalize the prior. I would say maybe that it's that it's sparse in the high frequencies or something. That's like
mm-hmm.
a common thing people say about natural images.
Right.
And now, with that prior, you can try to do a reconstruction that has some weighting of that prior in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And people do that. And then you would...
You're talking about compressed sensing?
Yeah. And then with the image that's been dithered, you'd you would get almost an exact reconstruction. And you just wouldn't with the non-dithered image.
Right. I hadn't even thought about this, what dither does when you have a sparse signal in the first place. Okay. I was just thinking as you were talking about this, and this may be a different point, that your prior can have a lot of information in it. You might look at the 2-bit image and it's like, okay, I can reconstruct that perfectly because I recognize that. That's Michelangelo's David. And, that wouldn't help me because I couldn't. As I was telling Lucian, why this is not a blackboard talk, because I'm completely incompetent drawing anything. But somebody could, right? Things like, okay, I've got it. You know, that's falls right out. Okay, these are all sort of a good and related questions about the, about really, I think, about how to quantify the benefit of dither. I mean, we know that subjectively, these signals, dithered signals, are preferable. You could see to some extent why, because as I said, you do take in extra, you take in information from, in the truncation case, the lower 8 bits, and you stick some of it into the upper 16. You can really see this at work, if anybody is interested in this, if you do look at real physical signal processors which oversample, which you're doing 1-bit sampling, and basically, well, they do 1-bit sampling and then produce a 24-bit representation by sampling at super high frequencies. And there what you're doing is you're knocking this original signal all over the place with the dither. And any particular measurement doesn't tell you anything, but the ensemble, the collection of measurements, so you're oversampling by, you know, maybe 10,000 times. You're maybe a 10,000 times the Nyquist rate. And you basically average that to create a single sample at the Nyquist rate. And you have a whole distribution of results, single bit results, which, given that the input signal was random, can tell you with high degree of confidence what the actual value was at that at a moment in that neighborhood. I'm not sure if that was clear, but it's a slightly different use of dithering, which basically uses the kind of averaging over this stochastic process, and you can see it working. It's ultimately, I think, the same phenomenon, but it's not obvious when you first look at it how it is. Raphael, you've had a...
I want to get back to your... I don't know if it's your main point, but your most provocative point.
Okay. Most provocative / indefensible.
If I can provoke it. Right. I don't want to attack it. I want to...
No, go ahead. Yeah. Good.
Understand what you're saying. So mm-hmm. You're saying that... Suppose that there is some other reality, like many of us believe, that's not captured by the wave function. We don't know what it is, but it describes what the quantum world really is. Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting that if we do an interference experiment or whatever, in the presence of a sufficient amount of decoherence, but not too much, not too little, then it'll give us a more accurate picture of what the true reality is than doing the more, the most decoherence free? Because that's what's happening.
Oh, I see, yeah. Yeah, the general idea was that what you associate with a lot, that the trajectories, the quasi-classical trajectories that you associate in quantum mechanics with a loss of information might be a better representation of what the world is like than the the result of the interference pattern, with the decoherence-free result. Mm-hmm.
One thing might be quasi-classical trajectories, that's one particular example, but one could go in general and say, suppose I look at, it's just like weak measurement is a different idea of measurement.
Right.
Is it giving a better or worse picture or neither or something? Mm-hmm. So this is another, it seems to me, possible proposal. Let's look at what mildly decoherent measurements tell us. Can that suggest to us what the real world is like, you know? It's giving a better view, and just like it's a better view to David's pupil or something. Mm-hmm. We're getting a better view of the true world, the real world, by doing that kind of measurement. I'm trying to push you to say that. I mean, that seems to me that's what...
It is, but I'm reluctant to sort of just sort of step back and say, well, the real world is classical, because I know that's not going to work.
Unless you do too much decoherence.
No, but you could.
Well, I'm not sure what, how we're quantifying what is meant in this context between
just enough and too much.
I don't know. That's, yeah, I don't know either.
I was talking about a case in which you have enough decoherence to. This is something I really don't even know about how an actual two-slit experiment. I don't even know what the detection efficiency is. Because my answer to the question earlier about too much noise is, well, if you have too much noise, the particles never make it to the screen. So, which is related to what you're asking, how much noise. And, I know that in EPR experiments, photon detection is extremely inefficient. It's both inefficient and ambiguous in the sense of like which you have particles.
I mean, in this three-slit experiment that was done at IQC.
Uh-huh.
I don't know the actual intrinsic efficiency of the detector. I don't think it's super great, but they had these heralded photons, what they called. So, you know, you produce two correlated photons, and then you have to detect a coincidence. And when you do that, I think you're pretty sure that that you've seen. What am I trying to say? You've seen the same one that was what? It wasn't background noise.
Mm-hmm.
You still might be.
Visibility isn't affected by the detector efficiency. It is affected by background noise.
Okay.
So I think we take one last question.
Yeah, so I think there are two ways in which a measurement can have finite resolution. So either it can be coarse graining or kind of quantization, or it can have itself kind of continuous outcomes, but it can be intrinsically noisy. And so the signal enhancement by dithering you get in the first case, but not in the second.
Mm-hmm.
So then my question would be, which of these two cases do we have for quantum measurements?
Well, how would you tell the difference? I mean, so the intrinsically noisy case, you're getting a spectrum of values which looks continuous. It doesn't have any particular obvious. You have that with the position measurement, but then the discreteness has to probably is going to have to do with the finiteness with it. You know, how much do you trust the measurement? You know, what's the window within which you trust it? So that's a kind of I think that's a kind of quantization, right? So if you have if you have a 1 meter range and you can detect things, you only trust your measurement plus or minus a centimeter, then is that analogous or not analogous to a quantum?
Initial conditions that you're measuring.
Right, but that's tricky because it sort of begs the question of how you determine whether you have the same initial conditions.
Yeah.
Is it because preparation is a kind of measurement almost, yeah. It's a good point, though, and I think I started to think about this question. I'm going to think about it some more. Thank you. All right, thanks, everybody. Appreciate the questions.